Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just had the great pleasure of talking with Susan Huang about her brand new book that's hot off the presses called Picturing the True Form, Taoist Visual Culture in Traditional China, and that just came out in 2012 with the Harvard University Asia Center. Now, this is a book on that right off the bat is gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's full of images that range across a wide variety of media. And it makes just an immensely pleasurable read for that reason, among others. Because the book is doing a kind of work that is explicitly arguing for understanding images, the production and use of images in a cultural context by looking at a wide range of media, it's an extraordinarily important and very useful intervention in understanding images, broadly speaking, in what we might call traditional China. This is a book that's going to be a reference for many of us for many, many, many years to come. It's going to be a classic work. And one of the reasons for that is precisely the fact that it speaks to so many different fields by the author having chosen a topic that's of extraordinarily wide relevance. In the course of this book, Susan Huang talks about a very particular religious and cultural context, and that is roughly 10th to 13th century China. But she's giving us a way to think about images beyond the simple figurative drawing on a paper, on a piece of paper, or figure on a painting, and that includes images that are invisible, images that are ephemeral, images that are very closely linked with what we might consider to be writing. It's a very rich study. We talked about a lot of really interesting parts of it, and I hope you will enjoy. I certainly did. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Carla.
We're here today to talk with Susan Huang about her new book, her really beautiful, just very gorgeous new book, Picturing the True Form, Taoist Visual Culture in Traditional China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Susan, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course. So, Susan, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to Chinese art history, and what brought you to this topic of Taoist images in particular?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Taiwan, and in college, I was actually an English major. I only began to study Chinese art history in graduate school. So what really brought me to the field is a very important mentor, Professor Shi Shoutian, who I met in the MA program when I studied at National Taiwan University. He was the person who really taught me how to look at Chinese paintings and how to contextualize art in history. He was also the key person who really encouraged me to study Taoist painting based on my personal interest at that time. So under his supervision, I wrote a master's thesis on the 14th century Taoist wall painting from the Taoist temple Yongle Gong in Shanxi. And in order to get a better training in Taoism, Professor Shi recommended me to take a Chinese religion class with Paul Katz, who at that time already worked at Academia Sinica and had just published some of the most fascinating studies on the Yongle Gong murals, although he focused on the hagiography of Lu Dongbing. My master's thesis has a very different focus. I was most interested in how these Taoist images were related to the broader professional workshop practice in the rural northern China. So this is also a study that reflects my early interest in doing interdisciplinary research. During that period, I also was very fortunate enough to study Buddhist art with Professor Li Yuming, who is also a research curator at the National Palace Museum in Taipei. And under her guidance, I get to know the scholarship of early Buddhist art, especially Dunhuang art. And after graduating from my MA program in Taiwan, I was fortunate enough to receive a government scholarship in Taiwan to study abroad. And I was luckily accepted by Yale to work under Richard Bornhardt, the authority of Chinese painting at that time. At Yale, I also continue my study of Chinese religions with Valerie Hansen, and I explore Japanese art with Professor Mimi Yenpu-Sawang. I wanted to continue my study on Taoist art. So in 1997, I went to Boston to see a show on Chinese painting. And there I found my dissertation topic, which is a set of fantastic Taoist paintings depicting the bureaucratic gods of heaven, earth, and water. And so that formed the basic topic of my dissertation. In my dissertation, I spent a lot of time looking at the details of the painting, trying to make sense of it in the place of history of art. So I date the paintings to the 12th century, and I argue that it was a rare example of the Southern Song Imperial Commission. In the later part of the dissertation, I also touch upon the issue of how religious paintings could be used in a Taoist ritual in Song China. So that's pretty much my background before I wrote this book.
Now, you mentioned, you've mentioned just now, and you also mentioned at the beginning of the book that this book did come from originally dissertation work or your work as a PhD student, and I'm assuming it transformed from one to the other. So can you talk a little bit about that transformation? Were there any major changes? Were there any major issues that you deal with here that weren't in the dissertation? What was that process like for you?
Well, you know, I finished my dissertation in 2002, and this book was out just now in 2012. So we are basically talking about a 10-year transformation. This is, for me, the most critical journey I've taken in my scholarly life as a scholar. And I have to say that my book is not a revision of the dissertation. It really reflects the interdisciplinary research that I developed after I got my PhD. So there are several ways to look at this transformation. Basically, I think they are very different in terms of the study questions, in terms of the primary sources, in terms of the methodology, and in terms of the intended audience. Speaking of the study questions, I think my dissertation, of course, dissertation is written for your advisor and a group of committee members. So it's very art history based. And also I mentioned that I dealt with problematic paintings. So dating the painting and looking at the style of the painting was the pressing issue for me in my dissertation. This book is not only an art history book, it really aims to talk to everyone who is interested in Chinese culture. So it deals with more broadly this issue of what Taoist visual culture is. And so in terms of, in order to answer this larger question, I have to use a new set of primary sources. The most crucial addition to this book in terms of the primary source is the Taoist canon, which is a monstrous compilation of Taoist texts compiled under the Ming Imperial Commission patronage in 1445. And in it, it contains nearly 1,500 texts, and a lot of them could be dated to Song or pre-Song. And so, you know, that forms the major database that I draw my evidence from. In terms of methodology, as I said, the dissertation is heavily art history based, but for this book, I am tackling all sorts of questions that may require other disciplines to help. Most importantly, are the methodologies used in the religious studies and also culture history study. In terms of the intended audience, I think that I hope that this book will not only address to art history readers, but also address to people interested in Chinese religions and Taoism in particular.
Thank you so much. Now, you've already actually mentioned a couple of the things that I'm delighted you've mentioned them, because these are things that are very striking about the book and that I wanted to sort of ask you to speak a little bit to anyway. One of the things brings us really into the body of the book. Now, the book indicates or investigates the visual culture of what you call religious Taoism, focusing, as you mentioned, on the 10th through 13th centuries, but really incorporating material and talking about phenomena that are from earlier and from later.
Right.
Now, one of the really wonderful and really striking things about the study is exactly this transdisciplinarity and this kind of multimedia approach that you're taking to incorporating lots of different kinds of images and objects and materials into this very comprehensive and synthetic account. Your use, especially for a historian, the use of the Daozang, or the Taoist canon, is wonderful in here, and it's very, very interesting. Can you talk a little bit about, especially since that you mentioned that that came into the study after, or maybe primarily after, the phase of this project that began its life in graduate work?
Right.
That came out after. So can you talk a little bit about the challenges of using that as a source? Were there any kinds of issues involved there with using a 15th century compilation to talk about Song and earlier materials? Did that come up for you at all? Were there any issues where you had any trouble dating those images to earlier than the 15th century or so on and so forth? So basically the set of questions is, can you talk about that as a source, and what was that like for you?
Yeah, that is a very good question and very important one. So thank you for addressing that at the beginning. I think the Taoist canon is a very daunting pool of primary sources. And since the 1970s, a lot of Taoist scholars have been working together, trying to sort out the dating issues and the content issues of these texts. I am really fortunate to be born in this moment when Christopher Schipper and Franciscus Verulam just published these three volumes, Monumental Research on the Taoist Canon, in 2004. And what they did is, this is a project that started in the 1970s. And I know that some of my Taoist teachers, when they were writing their dissertation in the 80s, they were already hoping that they could take advantage of this scholarly work. However, the book did not publish until 2004. So that says about how difficult it was to get into the detail of the Taoist canon. So the advantage of having these three-volume Daozang Tongkao, edited by Schipper and Verulam, is that it at least provide a kind of systematic framework for us to better access the text. It's very challenging to use a 15th century compilation to talk about pre-15th century stuff. So how are we going to go about that? Well, before we had better sources to address the Song Taoist visual culture, that unfortunately is still something I have to take advantage with. So the solution is to use a lot more comparative materials outside the Taoist canons. So for example, when I was talking about certain images or certain issues derived from the Taoist canon, the text that I think could be traceable to the Song or pre-Song, I try to look at archaeological materials or other visual sources that are comparable to the sources that I use in the Daoist canon and could be more firmly dated or contextualized in the medieval or Song context.
Thank you so much, Susan. That's very helpful. I mean, I think very reasonable and very wise. And I should say this, you're using all of these different kinds of materials is actually one of the very exciting things about the book. And it's one of the things that makes the book, I think, speak to a wide range of disciplines. So good job. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book as we get into the chapters. The book is divided into two sections, inner chapters and outer chapters, divided sort of loosely speaking to esoteric and exoteric realms of knowledge, respectively. Can you talk about that? How did you decide to structure the book in that way? And in what way is that a crucial part of what you're arguing in the book, if it is?
Right. Thank you for this question. I think that is another very important decision that I had to make. And that is, how do I put all these very complex ideas into a book length of production? And I was very impressed with this idea of inner versus outer as reflected in the categorization of Daoist texts themselves. And this idea could be evident in the extant works such as Bao Puzi. It has inner chapter, Nei Pian, and outer chapter, Wai Pian. The other example is the scripture of the Yellow Court, Huang Ting Jing. It also had the inner chapter and the outer chapter. And how these are divided speak to different audience. The Nei Pian, or the inner chapter, is supposed for more exclusive internal circulation of those ordained disciples, whereas the outer chapter or the Wai Pian are really meant for more general and public circulation. And Christopher Schipper and Francisca Verilin, when they published the Daozang Tongkao, the 2004 publication that I mentioned, they took this concept into serious plate, and they actually lay out Daoist texts from Daoist canon in terms of internal circulation versus general circulation. And that for me is very, very inspiring. So basically, I think that my division of the chapters into these two categories has something to do with the tradition of how Daoist knowledge was spread. But this is not to say that there is no overlap. This is not to say that whatever I put within these two categories are dichotomical. Are in two dichotomy. On the contrary, Taoism is very fluid idea, and also there is a lot of corresponding microcosm versus macrocosm, inner mirroring the outer. So in this book, I try my best to echo this. So whatever I discuss in the first part, when I see fit in the second part, I will brought it up again.
Now, each one of the chapters that is nestled within one of these two parts deals with a particular case study or set of case studies to look at a particular phenomena that are of import to this general set of issues. But throughout all of the chapters, there are three kinds of images that you bring out the importance of that may not be what readers or listeners immediately think of when they think of images. These are images that aren't reducible to the kind of picture on the wall or, drawing on the piece of paper of a fish or a bird or so, or what have you. These are images that really kind of help us stretch even outside of the context of Daoist imagery. They help us as readers stretch our notion of what an image is and what it could be. So I want to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, because this is so central to so much of what the book does, to talk a little bit about these three kinds of images. So the first kind of image is what you call an aniconic image. Mm-hmm. What is an aniconic image, and what, how is that important to understanding Taoist visuality?
Okay. Thank you for that, too. I think these are, these three kinds for me are very, very important. And I probably don't, because of the way that I structure the book, I do not highlight these terms in the title of the chapter, but I probably, this is something that I actually plan to work on my next project related to Taoist art. But on iconing, I think this is actually the kind of imagery that I think mark the most significant contribution Taoism had to Chinese visual culture. And I mean, I use aniconic literally and not interpretively. So basically, the aniconic refers to those images that are not figurative icons, which are usually assumed to be the core of Chinese religious art and especially Buddhist art. So what I'm talking about here is really to draw my reader apart from the mainstream of Buddhist art and to look at something different.
Great. So aniconic images, when you talk about these in the book, and they come up at several points in the book, you also mention the importance of writing.
Yes.
To these. Can you talk a little bit about that? How is writing important to these aniconic images?
Well, I think that maybe we should ask, why is aniconic so big in Taoism or Taoist visual culture? What is the strategy? What is the advantage of being aniconic? And for me, I am just about to gradually understand. So this is a kind of like, you know, progress report. I think that for an aniconic image, it gives the freedom to this sense of transformation. And this leads to the other key concept underlying the book, which is the true form or zhenxin. True form is also a very ambiguous term. And you know, I was very frustrated when I first go through all the researches in the Taoist canon and the Taoist literature, trying to kind of nail down what exactly are these terms, especially the true form. But the answer, I think, is a reasonable one. And that is, Taoists intentionally make it ambiguous and unpredictable because, visual forms of iconic elements and this literary reference to the true form, or evoke a kind of changing, transforming imagery of Taoism, which they claim is the true nature of things. And so in order to convey what is true, what is underlying, what is underneath what is more visible, I think an iconic approach is very forceful because it gives the maker of the symbols this liberty of including writing and other all sorts of miscellaneous abstract forms into consideration.
Great. And there's actually an entire chapter of the book, and we'll talk about this a little bit,
yeah,
that looks at this notion of true form as sort of some original shape that something had as part of the Tao, right? This sort of inner, invisible, or formless quality of an entity, as you put it here, in contrast to the outer, or visible, or concrete, and this idea of an aniconic mode of imagery that incorporates diagrams and charts and other kinds of elements, but explicitly resists a simplistic figurative representation is very interesting in that context.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if that's one of the major types of images that the book highlights, another one is images that are immaterial or invisible. So invisible images. This is also very striking. Can you talk about that and its importance to Taoist imagery?
Yeah. Well, I think that, immaterial image is especially important to highlight in this art history study because art historians are talking about material culture study, and it seems that, you know, we only study anything that is materialized. However, recently, a religious art historian, David Morgan, who is not working on the Chinese topic, I think that he and a group of scholars, try to reconceptualize the study of religious visual culture. And he pointed out that it's equally important to study the immaterial side of religious visual culture because it's so closely related to what is materialized. And I think this is especially true in the case of Taoism, especially when we talk about all these mental images that occurred in the adept's visualization. All these images only stay in the mind. And so what we analyze as illustrations from the meditative manual are just the visual aids for the adepts to better understand what it is and where it is in their visualization practice. So when we talk about immaterial, it really linked to this mental practice.
Thank you. And so if we have aniconic images, which are perhaps represented by these true form charts and incorporate elements we might otherwise think of as writing, and then we have invisible images or immaterial images, but an example of which, as you mentioned, is something like a sort of mental image that's conjured in the mind of an adept. The third kind of imagery that's very striking here is what you call an ephemeral image. What's an ephemeral image, and what might be an example of that in the context of this larger study of Taoist imagery?
Well, ephemeral evokes this idea of fleeting. You know, it only exists one time or shortly in a brief moment. And so I'm really talking about something including the ritual space. The Taoist ritual space is very portable. You know, as long as you have an incense burner, you light up the incense and you create a certain sacred space. But this space will be immediately dismantled as soon as the ritual is over. So space itself is ephemeral. Also, the objects made for ritual functions are often ephemeral. What is so interesting from this research is that I realized how important paper, this material, paper, played in Taoist materiality. And the use of paper in a lot of Taoist objects, sculptures, or documents sent to God, it has a meaning. There's a reason why the Taoists favor paper. And I think my interpretation is that, one, it's easy to transform. At the end of the ritual, all these paper materials are meant to be burned as a symbolic token of transforming the information to the other world. So ritual object itself could be ephemeral. But what about ritual performance? This goes back to David Morgan and S. Brandt Plate, their theory of religious visual culture in considering the transmediary subject in the study. Ritual performance itself is fleeting. It's a fleeting spectacle, and its dynamic quality has something to do with the core of Taoist visuality. So all of these go back to this keyword, true form, which implies transforming, throughout different media, throughout different realms of the world, throughout different stages of cultivation.
So if we could speak, as we move into this, the material of the chapters, let's stay on this idea of ephemerality for a moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
This is really striking, and I'm sure anybody who's going to read the book or listen to us talking about the book right now, I wouldn't be surprised if listeners and readers might be struck by not only the opportunities of looking at ephemeral images, including performances or including paper objects that are meant to be burned at the end of a ritual, is not just an opportunity, but also as a particular set of challenges. Can you talk a little bit about those challenges?
Yeah.
What for you have been the challenges of talking about ephemeral images, especially in the context of 10th to 13th century cultural practices?
Sure. Well, you know, because most historians study the hard materials that survive, and for ages, our historians also think so. We study only what is extant. We reach conclusion based on what is available right now. So there is a practical challenge to study what does not, what was no longer exist, what was no longer here, but existed one time before. I have to be a little bit creative in using study materials. And I think what is wonderful about the Taoist canon is that in Song Dynasty, especially around 13th century, there are several monumental liturgical manuals compiled in China. And these liturgical manuals all have a rich repository of ritual objects. And it is not to say that we can just be very sure to claim that, well, what we see as the samples of ritual objects illustrated in the Taoist canons of those 13th century manuals are those actual objects used by people at that time. But at least they gave us a kind of a leeway, give us a glimpse of what might be like. Also, to study performance, it's equally difficult, if not more. You know, we can study what has been recorded as the proper ritual and try to imagine the actions, the sequence, and the dramatic performance at that time. But most importantly, I think that historians would benefit from the ethnographical studies of the contemporary field work done by many scholars, John Lagaway, to name a few. So this is the way that I that I address the question.
Thank you so much, Susan. Now, as we get into the book, part one looks at, as we've mentioned, inner or esoteric Taoist images associated with practices like meditation, visualization, and breathing practices. So the first chapter looks at how Taoist perceptions of the body and the cosmos unfolded over time, and you focus this chapter on four types of images: body gods, imaginary journeys to the stars, what we might call grotesque spirits and body worms, which are super, super cool and sort of worth the price of admission just for that discussion. And also transformation of the body through internal alchemy. If you would, could you talk about one or more of these types of images and say a little bit about sort of what they are and how an adept or a practitioner would have used these images in the course of practice?
Sure. I chose to talk about this at the beginning of the book because I also think it makes sense that Taoist history of images began with this group. And, you know, this could be traced back to the Han Dynasty or to the records in Taiping Jing, one of the earliest Taoist texts, about how adept use images to meditate in private. And the other key issue that I think, you know, is brought up by these materials here that would maintain important throughout the book is this correspondence theory that sees the self, you know, ourself and the universe as a kind of correspondence, a mirroring effect of microcosm versus macrocosm. And that is why, you know, I think that it's important to talk about body and cosmos in chapter one. For me, I think some of the images are really fascinating to study. Body gods, this concept of body gods and body worms are very unique in Taoism, and you do not find it in Buddhism, for example. So that in itself already highlight the special quality of Taoist visual culture. I agree with you. I think that the body worms are very cool, you know, invention of Taoist symbols. And we were talking about something that looked abnormal, something like, you know, a leg that form the entire body. In Dunhuang manuscript, recent discovery of Song tombs, we found comparable examples of ceramic figurines. We say it is figurine, but it's actually these kind of worms that share the very same symbols. So that I think shed light on the visual culture of Chinese medicine and disease as well. That is something that I think is very cool. The other thing that I think is fascinating to study with is the body chart that is tied to this Song practice of inner alchemy, Song and Yuan. And this really is a new phenomenon starting from the Song, even though inner alchemy already prospered in the Tang. But in the Tang, it's more text-based, whereas after the Song, you see more and more new symbols invented as part of the visual aids for these very kind of like arcane book.
Now, this is, I'll also mention for listeners as we move through the chapters, there's a really interesting point for anybody interested in some kind of a more global history or a history of circulation. There's a point in which you show that images of the medical body and sort of body organs, we might call them, possibly right. circulated into Persian texts. And so yeah. for listeners, you can find that on page 75. There's also a really interesting set of discussions about wooden models of inner organs that were yeah. stuffed inside bronze models of the human body. So really, really interesting stuff. And also an interesting discussion of miniaturization as mm-hmm. a phenomenon. So all really cool things in this chapter. So as we move to the next chapter, chapter two looks at the shaping of Taoist cosmography. And it right. takes us through some of the major questions that we might have about that world. And you give us some of these questions. What were the components of the Taoist world from the time of its creation to the time when heaven, earth, and hell were fully inhabited by lots of different specific divinities and beings? How were these places connected? What kinds of visual language did Taoists use to make sense of this cosmography? And how do these contributions relate to other aspects of Chinese culture? And these are all questions that you pose for us at the beginning of that chapter. Can you talk a little bit about this? How do, in your study of this chapter, how are images used in particular, and how does a kind of visual language come up as Taoists try to circumnavigate these processes and these questions? So what's the use of, what kind of surprising uses of images do we see in this chapter?
Okay. Well, first I'd like to say why I write this chapter. It was actually not in the original plan to write a chapter called Mapping the World. But the question came when I wrote chapter three. And I realized that I have so many questions about the Taoist world that I have to address. And so I have to go back to create a new chapter. And so that was actually quite challenging to me. But I think it's a very important question for Taoist adepts who actually embark on this mental journey to everywhere in the universe. They got to know where to go and how to go correctly. And however, unlike the European counterpart in medieval period, where we can see a very clear map of the world, the so-called TO map, placing this world in relation to heaven or the paradise, Christian paradise. The Taoist notion of cosmology is very vague and not at all a coherent system. I think that's number one to acknowledge. So any effort to kind of just nail down and say that, hey, this is it, would be misleading. And I, in my book, I do not try to say that this is a coherent system. In terms of the visual materials that I use to address these questions of the Taoist world, I found it, and actually that's a surprise, I found it's very helpful to consult the ritual space design recorded in Taoist canon, and especially in those texts that are dated to the Southern Song, to the 13th century. The way that some of the Taoist ritual space is laid out actually echoes the macrocosm of the world. So this goes back to, again, the concept of microcosm versus macrocosm. I think one of the biggest surprise that I came up from this chapter is how important earthly paradise is in Taoist cosmology. And I see it as a contribution, as a unique contribution in the Taoist side among the different religions in medieval period. This earthly paradise referred to a mixture of real places, such as the five sacred mountains, the Wu Yue, or the imaginary places, such as the Member Mountain. So it's very imaginative. This is also a concept that stimulates Chinese landscape painting and had a really profound impact in Chinese art. So that's kind of something that I think worth highlighting.
And among the kinds of images that you look at, or the kinds of materials that you look at in this chapter, we get discussions of mirrors and steles and robes. It's very interesting. Now, one of the things that happens in this chapter, I want to ask you a little bit about, because it's something that also happens in later chapters of the book, and this is something that you've alluded to, but perhaps we can take a moment to talk about it, because it seems very important, and that is the relationship between Taoist and Buddhist materials, and in particular, the kinds of cosmological images presented in these texts that you're calling Taoist texts, and those in Buddhist materials. Can you talk about this relationship, because the relationship between Taoist imagery and Buddhist imagery seems very important as something that you're talking about here, and it's something that that recurs throughout the book.
Right. The main goal of this book is try to sort out what is the features of Taoist visual culture. But inevitably, I have to use Buddhist materials as comparative sources in order to make a judgment of whether or not this is unique in Taoism. And that is how the comparison came across. I think that if we accumulate the scholarship of Taoist art, maybe we'll be ready to do a real project, just compare Buddhist art and Taoist art face to face. Coming back to this chapter regarding the comparative role of Buddhist cosmology, I think that what came out here is that, there is a sense of competition among different religions. So Buddhist cosmology is a more well-defined concept in medieval China. This was not really totally new that Chinese people invented. It was something that was shared across the Buddhist culture. So I think that when the Taoists, construct their worldview, they very much make references to the Buddhist existing counterpart. And what is more interesting is that they want to go beyond, they want to surpass the Buddhist counterpart. And one example is the layout of heavens. The Taoist heavens have multiple layers, just like Buddhists, but then, intentionally on top of the so-called three realms, Sanjie, that defined the Buddhist cosmology, Taoists say that, well, we have more layers on top. And in addition to building up vertically, Taoist cosmology, in comparison to the Buddhist one, also expand laterally. And I think this lateral expansion is extremely interesting. And what I just mentioned about the idea of earthly paradise fell into this category. I think what is lateral implies what is more accessible to the human world, because you are now on the same level. So it's a paradise that you can reach, or you can reach with better ease, not like you have to go up to heaven.
Thank you, Susan. Now, in the next chapter, we focus on this concept and set of images surrounding something that's extraordinarily important that you've already spoken a little bit about, and that's the idea of the true form. Now, Chapter 3 explores this genre of Taoist pictures known as true form charts, especially those associated with earthly paradises, as you just were talking a little bit about. Can you talk a little bit about these charts? What were these true form charts, and in what way are they crucial for the work that you're doing in this chapter?
Yes. I want to say that this is actually the most difficult chapter for me. It was very difficult to compose, to make sense of the miscellaneous and fragmented sources that I gather. So the true form charts here refer to a specific category of Taoist symbol. And I want to make a difference from a more general reference or general use of the term true form in my book and in the title of the book. In this chapter, I'm really talking about this specific type of images. But throughout the book, I use the true form more freely to refer to this sort of underlying secret phenomena of the nature. So these true form charts that I refer to have some common grounds. First of all, they seem to all refer to mountains, and that's very interesting. That actually speak about how important mountain is in Taoist cosmology. And secondly, in terms of the composition, all these true form charts seem to be in square form, and it has both text and image to a certain extent. So there is this interplay between text and image. And some of the texts are legible, whereas some are not intentionally. Do I answer your question?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Now, one of the really interesting things that you argue about these charts is that there was a particular way that the creators of these charts ensured the secret or esoteric transmission of the material that they were communicating. So can you talk a little bit about that? How did practitioners assure the secrecy and sort of secret esoteric transmission of this material?
This is really, really fascinating, and I just gradually realized that this is the kind of game rule that Taoism play, and I think that we are hitting upon a broader implication of Taoist visual culture that could be developed from this chapter, and that is, what is the Taoist strategy of knowledge transmission? I think one thing that is very different from Buddhism is that Taoism is very secret. It is very selective. In many medieval texts that I study, it ends with a warning saying that you cannot leak the information. If you leak the information, your ancestors of seven generations will be damned, things like that. Or say something like, if you cannot find the proper person to transmit, it better throw it away or hide it in the water or the mountain. And how rare this transmission occur. Every 33 years, every 100 years, every 500 years, things like that. So Taoist strategy of secrecy is incomprehensibility. I think that to make it incomprehensive, to make the chart with a mixture of illegible text and abstract forms, kind of enhance the security code of this knowledge. So only the master who study with another master would know how to look at this image. And so the transmission is not enough just by looking at the image. There is a lot of other things to do that we don't know at this point. But I think that is very important to note about these charts.
Now, the second part of the book takes us from this inner or esoteric realm of knowledge to an outer or exoteric realm of knowledge, keeping in mind, of course, as you also remind us in the book, that these two modes are not necessarily strictly dichotomous, and we have elements of the esoteric and exoteric that lead in and out of all of these chapters. So in these last three chapters, you look at the material culture and spatial design of Taoist ritual space, ritual performance, and finally liturgical paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 4 looks in particular at the materiality of Taoist ritual space in a really interesting set of discussions that looks at a lot of the objects, large and small, that go into creating and using Taoist ritual space. So to talk about this chapter, could you for us talk a little bit about this space? What is the nature of the Taoist ritual space, or as you call it here, enclosure of the Tao?
Mm-hmm.
And how was this kind of space used by a practitioner? And you mentioned that there's two forms of this space. So could you say a little bit about that?
Sure. I talk about the meditation chamber, the oratory, as the first type of space. And then I move on to the altar as the second type of space. And I think it's more important to note that the altar space went through a transformation throughout time. And so how it was constructed also vary in different time. And to acknowledge the change of altar space, it's important for us to consider the production of different kinds of Taoist art, including Taoist paintings. Because, for example, the Taoist altar, starting from the 10th century, seemed to have a tendency to move indoors. And so there is a kind of transformation from the so-called centralized altar, which looked like a stage higher up, like a mountain, and often placed outdoor, to a rim, like a rim structure. And when things move to the indoor, then the objects used in the ritual were not only placed at the altar table, but were pushed to the three walls, eliting the entrance at that side. So only the three walls. And that is when the paintings came to the scene in Taoist ritual. And so I think that the study of Taoist sacred space has something to do with the development of Taoist objects and paintings as well.
Great. Now, some of the objects that you talk about as being crucial to the use and organization of this space in this chapter include flags and banners. They include these ephemeral objects like paper, spirit money, and written documents to the gods that bring up the issue of ephemerality of sources, as we were talking about before. But they also include smaller objects that may not have been visible to people who would have witnessed these rituals. Now, these objects include two in particular that are really, really interesting. Writing utensils, like a writing knife.
Yeah.
And also mirrors. Could you say a little bit about mirrors in particular in their use in creating this kind of a space? Because this is images created on mirrors and with mirrors, or sort of the images related to the use of mirrors in this kind of practice are really fascinating. And so can you speak a little bit to that?
Thank you. So first of all, I want to thank the anonymous reviewer of my book. Actually, one reviewer suggested that I write a specific section on Taoist mirror. And although I did mention Taoist mirror here and there, and I really took his advice and spent several months to write these 10 pages. So I appreciate that, U.S. Taoist mirror in the ritual context was used mostly to for exorcism purpose, and that is to get rid of the demons, because the Taoists believe that the mirror has this magical power of revealing the true form. So now we are, going back to this key concept of mirror. And the other interesting thing about Taoist mirror used in ritual practice is that the design of the Taoist mirror seemed to be very different from the mainstream Chinese bronze mirrors that we see, in history. A major difference is that Taoist mirror design focus on talisman, focus on writing. And this goes back to one of the modes that I highlighted at the beginning of the book and we mentioned about briefly, and that is uniconic, and also the importance of writing in Taoist ritual. I have to note, though, that there is another kind of Taoist mirror used in visualization practice, and that was not the focus of this chapter. And I briefly mentioned that the design of that kind of mirror has to be just plain. So it's different from what we see in this book.
Thank you, Susan. Now, as we move to the next chapter, and this is sort of bringing us to the final chapters of the book, Chapter 5 discusses the yellow register purgation, which is a very particular salvation ritual, which was popular in Song China. Can you speak a little bit about this? Why was this ritual so important, and in what way does this particular ritual allow you to say some interesting things about images in Taoist ritual culture in this context? Because it does. I'll say as a reader, there's some really fascinating images that you give us here in the context of this ritual. So can you talk a little bit about that? What is this ritual and in what way is it important here?
Okay. Yeah. Well, this ritual, first of all, was recorded in a lot of popular sources of that time, including Hong Mai's Yi Jian Zhi, that a lot of historians use when they talk about popular culture of the Song. So that was my kind of opening to the chapter. I took my reader to see the Huang Lu Zhai, or the Yellow Register Purgation, through the eye of ordinary observers, just, you know, people who are share the view of Hong Mai. And oftentimes, what was recorded about Huang Lu Zhai in this type of sources focus on the dramatic encounter of the ghost and the living and the dead. The kind of manifestation of the dead. And then the living people there are often the family member of the dead, and they became really sad and very emotional. That is the kind of scenario we got from this type of source. But I think that is not enough. So I actually look into the liturgical sources in Taoist canon. And as I mentioned, the several compilations of 13th century liturgical manuals preserved in Taoist canons are very helpful. In these liturgical sources, they're very specific about the procedures, what you do as the step one and step two, step three. And when you do step one, what kind of talismans do you need to use? Where do you need to turn? Where in the Taoist ritual space do you go? Things like that. So I'm combining these two kinds of textual sources, trying to reconstruct a scenario of the performance. I think in terms of the ritual performance, a lot of religious scholars have studied this, and Ed Davis in his book have talked about this in greater depth. But in summary, the Huang Lu Zhai, or the Yellow Register purgation, aims at rescuing the soul that was suffering, that was believed to be trapped in the underground prison. So what the priest would do is to go through a series of performances, starting from attacking on hell. In Chinese, it's called Po Yu, or breaking hell, and that is to get the gods some permission to open the lock of the hell and to get those suffering souls out. Once the souls were out, they have to go through a series of purifying process, bathing, and they have to be fed, feeding, so that they could be escorted away to the proper space. So after the attack on hell, the next procedure of this Huang Lu Zhai ritual is bathing and feeding. And we have to imagine that people performing this ritual are moving around in the ritual space. There was no single a static space. They are actually moving around. And the concluding rite of this ritual is something very unique to Taoism, something that you don't see in the contemporary Buddhist practice, and that is called Lian Yu, or salvation through refinement. This is a very beautiful concept. The goal is to forge new divinities out of the diseased source by way of the ritual master's refinement of his own body. So there is a pairing of the outer ritual, what ordinary people could see, and the inner ritual, something that was going through the visualization of the priest's mind, that I find very fascinating.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Susan. Now, as we come to the final chapter before the epilogue, chapter six, I just want to ask you another question or two just as we wrap up. Now, chapter six looks at the dynamism, as you call it, of Taoist paintings, and it takes us through their processes of manufacture, their visual conventions, and their role in ritual. Most of this chapter focuses on actually something that you brought up at the beginning of our conversation today,
right.
Which is this Boston triptych.
Yeah.
The three officials of heaven, earth, and water that depicts three pictorial types that are used to image mobile deities, which reflect animating processes that are visualized by a ritual master, as you say. And these three types are heavenly descent, earthly excursion, and ocean crossing. Okay, so this is just to sort of lay that out there so you don't have to go into that in too much detail and I can ask you some questions. So one of the really interesting things about this chapter is that you explain for us kind of how a Taoist painter might typically have worked. And this is really interesting for the purpose of production. So I'd love to ask you to talk a little bit about that. If you were a Taoist painter creating one of these images, what would that creation involve?
Yeah. Right. I think that this is a fundamental question to art historians who are looking at Taoist paintings with Taoist scholars. You know, Taoist scholars are more preoccupied with the ritual and religious questions, whereas the art historians would think about how to relate Taoist paintings to the broader kind of professional paintings. So I think that to start this chapter with the question of how Taoist paintings were created, it's very appropriate, at least to me. And I think that one of the major implications that I want to touch upon by writing this is to raise the tension between the so-called iconography and generic figural type or visual conventions. I think that this has to be acknowledged before we really talk about what is the feature of the iconography of this image. So for a painter making Taoist paintings, he has to go through a series of procedures, including collecting samples, collecting visual types, to kind of draft the composition, and he has to look for inspiration, and not only from the sketchbook, the professional sketchbook, but also from the earlier work of art. And I think one very eccentric story that I read is this 10th century artist, Sun Zhiwei. In order to paint a ghost, he actually go to a spirit medium, Ling Mei, which is often a woman in Chinese society. And this spirit medium was able to summon a ghost from the underworld and to ask him, what do you see there? Sun Zhiwei, the painter's major question is, how do you differ God from ghost or demon from from God? And so this ghost summoned from the underground say that God are often look like a king, you know, it's magnificent, it's handsome, whereas ghosts have this deformed shape, things like that. As much as it's very cliche, I think that it pointed out to the kind of unusual process a painter is challenged to go through in the making of religious painting like this.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. And I can just to mention for listeners as well as we wrap up, there's also a really wonderful account in this chapter of the way an adept might have actually used this a painting like the Boston Triptych as an element in self-cultivation, and you argue that these triptychs were essentially portable Taoist altars. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very interesting material. And it's a beautiful, gorgeous book. So as we come to the close of our discussion, Susan, of this beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful book, there's so much in here that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's an extraordinarily rich book, and it's just a testament to what an amazing contribution it is. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to make sure to mention for listeners, especially perhaps for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book?
Well, I think that we touch upon, the most important key issues, and for reader to digest, I would encourage everyone to go to the book that would give all these questions more respectful answer. I think that I can talk a little bit about the overall goal and what we can expect next from this book. And I think that I hope that this book will encourage more study that break through the categories of art or categories of knowledge, and to study religious visual culture as a whole. And to do this, we of course need cooperation. We need to share our resources. We need to continue having conversations between art historians and people working on texts and religious materials. And I think it's, I hope that this will encourage more scholars to do, to ask broader questions rather than just focus on case studies.
Wonderful. Well, so now that we've got this completely wonderful, gorgeous book that I'm sure is going to be a reference work for many, 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 many years to come, what's next for you? What project is currently inspiring you right now?
All right. So, the book just published, so I was still in the aftermath.
Right, the afterglow. Right.
I do have some ideas of my next two projects. The two book-length projects, one deal with Taoist issue of text and image, and I think I want to tackle this issue of image text, and even perhaps bring it to a theoretical level. And to do so, I want to continue studying the various symbols in Taoist canon. What I have presented to my readers in the book is just a piece of the iceberg of the whole thing. So this may take a while, but I think it's worthwhile to pursue. The second project, I want to shift from Taoism to Buddhist side. And this is something that I have been doing for a while. And it focused on the early Buddhist illustrated prints. So it talked about the book culture. It talked about material religion, how Buddhism used prints in particular to spread knowledge. And in this project, I'm most interested in addressing the cross-cultural issues, because from the 10th to 13th century, we do have a wonderful collection, a very rich body of existing Buddhist prints, not only from Song China, but also from the Liao, from the Jin, and especially from the Xixia kingdom. So I want to use these materials to make comparison. Two main questions that I plan to investigate in this project concerns how visual motifs undergo change and transformation, both when transposed from one media to another and when from one place to the other. So that's about the basic idea.
Well, those both sound like great projects, Susan. So best of luck. Best of luck with that work. Congratulations again on this really wonderful book. And thank you so much for making the time to talk today.
Thank you so much for the interview. And thank you for your interest in the book.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thank you so much for making the time to be with us today. And I'll look forward to seeing you next time.